Well, it's time for us to wish our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today a very happy birthday on this March 13th. We have Beverly A. Jablinski from Evansdale, Doris Smith from Ames, Dolores Homer from Des Moines, Ken Bachhoven from Mason City, and Karen Kleppe from Anamosa. All of us here at IRIS would like to wish the five of you a very happy birthday. This is a reminder that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so that we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now let's turn to today's obituaries, of which there is only one, which I'll take care of. I'll read. Arlene June Brown, née Barnes, 98, died March 8, 2024, at Valley View Village. Visitation will be held Friday, March 15th, from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Hamilton's Southtown Funeral Home at 5400 Southwest 9th Street, immediately followed by a graveside service at 11:30 a.m. at Sunset Memorial Garden Cemetery. A memorial service will be held Saturday, March 16th at 10 a.m. at the Valley View Village Chapel at 2571 Guthrie Avenue in Des Moines. To express condolences and to see a full obituary, you can go to www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. And now here's Barb to continue with today's Des Moines Register.
Thank you, Dennis. Buttigieg says Boeing needs to cooperate with investigators. With Boeing facing multiple government investigations, the company needs to make a serious transformation around its safety and manufacturing quality, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said Monday. The comments came one day after Buttigieg said the aircraft builder is under enormous scrutiny by his department since a panel blew off a Boeing 737 MAX jetliner in mid-flight. Last weekend, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Department of Justice launched a criminal investigation into the January 5th blowout on an Alaska Airlines jet. That followed the company's admission that it couldn't find records that the National Transportation Safety Board sought for work done on the panel at a Boeing factory. The Federal Aviation Administration, part of Buttigieg's department, is also investigating Boeing. Quote, obviously, we respect the independence of the Department of Justice and NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, doing their own work, Buttigieg told reporters Monday. But we are not neutral on the question of whether Boeing should fully cooperate with any entity, NTSB, us, or DOJ. They should, and we expect them to. Buttigieg said Boeing must go through a serious transformation here in terms of their responsiveness, their culture, and their quality issues. Boeing gave a one-sentence response. Quote, we will continue to cooperate fully and transparently with all government investigations and audits as we take comprehensive action to improve safety and quality at Boeing, the company said. Alaska Airlines said it is cooperating with the Justice Department investigation. In an event like this, it's normal for the DOJ to be conducting an investigation, the Seattle-based airline said in a statement. We are fully cooperating and do not believe we are a target of the investigation. The New York Times reported Tuesday that Boeing failed 33 of 89 FAA audits during an examination following the blowout on the Alaska Airlines jet. The wide-ranging six-week audit found dozens of problems in various parts of the 737 MAX, the newspaper reported, citing a slide presentation on the audits of aspects of the production process. The report said 7 of 13 audits that focused on Spirit Aerosystems, which makes the body of the aircraft, also failed. One example cited was the use of liquid Dawn dish soap to lubricate a door seal during a fit-up process. The audits dealing with the door plug, the part that blew off the Alaska Airlines jet, found issues at both Boeing and Spirit Aerosystems. In an emailed comment on the report, Boeing said Tuesday that it was continuing to implement changes and to develop a comprehensive action plan to strengthen safety and quality and build the confidence of our customers and their passengers. We are squarely focused on taking significant, demonstrated action with transparency at every turn, the company said. And the High Court extends a pause on Texas migrant law. The U.S. Supreme Court extended a pause Tuesday on a Texas law that would allow police to arrest migrants accused of crossing into the country illegally as federal and state officials prepare for a showdown over immigration enforcement. Justice Samuel Alito's order extending the hold on the law until Monday came a day before the previous hold was set to expire. The extension gives the court an extra week to consider what opponents have called the most extreme attempt by a state to police immigration since an Arizona law that was partially struck down by the Supreme Court in 2012. U.S. District Judge David Ezra had rejected the law last month, calling it unconstitutional and rebuking multiple aspects of the legislation in a 114-page ruling that also brings of an invasion along the southern border. But a federal appeals court stayed the ruling, and the Justice Department asked the Supreme Court to intervene. Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed the law, known as Senate Bill 4, in December. It is part of his heightened measures along the state's boundary with Mexico, testing how far state officials can go to prevent migrants from crossing into the U.S. illegally after border crossings reached record highs. Senate Bill 4 would also give local judges the power to order migrants arrested under the provision to leave the country or face a misdemeanor charge for entering the U.S. illegally. Migrants who don't leave after being ordered to do so could be arrested again and charged with a more serious felony. In an appeal to the High Court, the Justice Department said the law would profoundly alter the status quo that has existed between the United States and the states in the context of immigration for almost 150 years. U.S. officials have also argued it would hamper the government's ability to enforce federal immigration laws and harm the country's relationship with Mexico. The battle over the immigration enforcement law is one of multiple legal disputes between Texas officials and the Biden administration over the extent to which the state can patrol the Texas-Mexico border to hamper illegal crossings.
RNC layoffs follow Trump's takeover of committee. Donald Trump's makeover of the Republican National Committee is now in full force, with layoffs of more than 60 people and plans to move some operations to South Florida. The moves come as Trump announces that, quote, freeing the January 6 prisoners are part of a first-day agenda that includes sealing the border and increasing oil and gas production. The RNC upheaval arrives less than a week after party members elected a new leadership team of allies to the former president and presumptively Republican presidential nominee. The new team is sending dismissal notices to around 60 people across the RNC's political, data, and communications departments. According to two people familiar with the plans, some employees will be allowed to reapply for their jobs. The new RNC also plans to move digital and fundraising teams to South Florida near the ex-president's Mar-a-Lago home in Palm Beach, resources said, part of an effort to align the Trump campaign with the RNC. RNC members elected Michael Whatley as their new chair on Friday, along with the former president's daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, as a co-chair. Whatley, a close Trump supporter, previously served as the North Carolina Republican Party state chair. The committee shakeup highlights some concerns that the Republican Party and the RNC will become a Trump-focused fundraising machine. Some RNC delegates expressed concern that it would be used to finance Trump's massive legal bills. Trump aides said they would not do that. The RNC has faced lagging fundraising numbers, with just around $8 million at the end of last year. Chris La Civita, who now works for the RNC as well as the Trump presidential campaign, previewed the changes last week. During the meeting in Houston at which the new leaders were elected, La Civita told reporters that the RNC would not look the same moving forward. There's obviously going to be some changes. Meanwhile, Trump said in his first day agenda as president will include pardoning people convicted of crimes related to the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, reviving his defense of the post-election insurrection that was part of his GOP primary campaign. Quote, my first act as your next president will be to close the border, drill, baby drill, and free the January 6 hostages being wrongfully imprisoned, Trump said Monday on his Truth Social website. During the Republican primary campaign, Trump often played up January 6 issues because many of his supporters believe the defendants have been treated unfairly. Democrats, said Trump, is prepared to let all of them go, but voters will not permit it because they will not put him back in the White House. The American people haven't forgotten the violent attack at our Capitol on January 6, Chitka said. They know Trump is too dangerous to be let anywhere near the Oval Office again.
The Pentagon to give Ukraine $300 million in aid. The Pentagon will rush about $300 million in weapons to Ukraine after finding some cost savings in its contracts, even though the military remains deeply overdrawn and needs at least $10 billion to replenish all the weapons it has pulled from its stocks to help Kyiv in its desperate fight against Russia, the White House announced Tuesday. As the Pentagon's first announced security package for Ukraine since December, when it acknowledged that it was out of replenishment funds. It wasn't until recent days that officials publicly acknowledged that they weren't just out of replenishment funds, but $10 billion overdrawn. The announcement comes as Ukraine is running dangerously low on munitions, and efforts to get fresh funds for weapons have stalled in the House because of Republican opposition. U.S. officials have insisted for months that the United States wouldn't be able to resume weapons deliveries until Congress provided the additional replenishment funds, which are part of the stalled supplemental spending bill. The replenishment funds have allowed the Pentagon to pull existing munitions, air defense systems, and other weapons from its reserve inventories under Presidential Drawdown Authority, or PDA, to send to Ukraine, and then put contracts on order to replace those weapons, which are needed to maintain U.S. military readiness. When Russian troops advance and its guns fire, Ukraine does not have enough ammunition to fire back, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said in announcing the $300 million in additional aid. The Pentagon also has had a separate Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, or ASAI, which has allowed it to fund longer-term contracts with industry to produce new weapons for Ukraine. Some defense officials who briefed reporters said the Pentagon was able to get cost savings in some of those longer-term contracts of roughly $300 million, and, given the battlefield situation, decided to use those savings to go ahead and send more weapons. The officials said the cost savings basically offset the new package and keep the replenishment spending underwater at $10 billion. One of the officials said the package represented a one-time shot. Unless Congress passes the supplemental spending bill, which includes roughly $60 billion in military aid for Ukraine, or more cost savings are found, it is expected to include anti-aircraft missiles, artillery rounds, and armor systems, the official said. The aid announcement comes as Polish leaders are in Washington to press the U.S. to break its impasse over replenishing funds for Ukraine at a critical moment in the war. Polish President Andrzej Duda met Tuesday with Democratic and Republican leaders in the House and Senate and was to meet with President Joe Biden later in the day. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, has so far refused to bring the $95 billion package, which includes aids for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, to the floor. Seeking to put pressure on the Republican Speaker, House Democrats have launched a long-shot effort to force a vote through a discharge petition. The seldom successful procedure would require support from a majority of lawmakers, or 218 members, to move the aid package to a vote. Ukraine's situation has become more dire, with units on the front line rationing munitions as they face a vastly better supplied Russian force. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has repeatedly implored Congress for help, but House Republican leadership has not been willing to bring Ukraine aid to the floor for a vote, saying any aid must first address border security needs. Pentagon officials said Monday during budget briefing talks they were counting on the supplemental to cover the $10 billion replenishment hole. If we don't get the $10 billion, we would have to find other means, Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks said. Right now, we're very much focused on the need for that supplemental. This is the second time in less than 9 months that the Pentagon has found money to use for additional weapons shipments to Ukraine. Last June, defense officials said they had overestimated the value of the weapons the U.S. had sent to Ukraine by $6.2 billion over the past 2 years. At the time, Pentagon officials said a review found that the military services used replacement costs rather than the book value of the equipment that was pulled from the Pentagon stocks and sent to Ukraine. The discovery resulted in a surplus that the department used for presidential drawdown packages until the end of December. The United States has committed more than $44.9 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the Biden administration, including more than $44.2 billion since the beginning of Russia's invasion on February 24, 2022. The Pentagon is $10 billion overdrawn in its replenishment account, in part due to inflationary pressures, and in part because the new systems the Pentagon is seeking replace the old systems which cost more, such as the upcoming Precision Strike Missile, or PRSM, which the Army is buying to replace the long-range Army Tactical Missile Systems, or ATACMS. The vast majority of those munitions have come from Army stockpiles due to the nature of the conventional land war in Ukraine. The months without further shipments of U.S. support have hurt operations, and Ukrainian troops withdrew from the eastern city of Avdiivka last month, where outnumbered defenders had withheld a Russian assault for 4 months. CIA Director William Burns told Congress that entire Ukrainian units have told him in recent days of being down to their last few dozen artillery shells and other ammunition. Burns called for the retreat from Avdiivka a failure of ammunition supply, resupply, not a failure of Ukrainian will.
In more Ukrainian news, Ukraine drones strike deep in Russia. Reports say pro-Ukrainian Russians make incursion. Ukrainian long-range drones smashed into two oil facilities deep inside Russia on Tuesday, officials said, while an armed incursion claimed by Ukraine-based Russian opponents of the Kremlin unnerved a border region just days before Russia's presidential election. The attack by waves of drones across eight regions of Russia displayed Kyiv's expanding technological capacity as the war extends into its third year. The cross-border guard assault also weakened President Vladimir Putin's argument that life in Russia has been unaffected by the war, though he remains all but certain to win another six-year term after eliminating all opposition. The reports of border fighting were murky, and it was impossible to ascertain with any certainty what was unfolding in Russia's Kursk and Belgorod regions. Cross-border attacks in the area have occurred sporadically since the war began and have been the subject of claims and counterclaims, as well as disinformation and propaganda. Soldiers who Kyiv officials say are Russian volunteers fighting for Ukraine claim to have crossed the border. The Freedom of Russia Legion, the Russian Volunteer Corps, and the Siberian Battalion released statements and videos on social media claiming to show them on Russian territory. They said they wanted a Russia liberated from Putin's dictatorship. The authenticity of the videos couldn't be independently verified. Fighters coming out of Ukraine attempted to reach the town of Tatkino, which lies close to the border, according to the governor of Russia's Kursk region, Roman Starovoyt. He said Tatkino was being shelled. There was an attempt by a sabotage and reconnaissance group to break through. There was a shooting battle, but there was no breakthrough, he said in a video message on Telegram. The Russian Defense Ministry said the Tatkino attacks were driven back, but provided no further details. It also said Ukrainian fighters made at least four attempts to cross into the Belgorod region, but all attacks were repelled by warplanes, artillery, and missiles. The representative of Ukraine's intelligence agency, Andriy Yusov, told Ukrainska Pravda that the military groups were made up of Russian citizens. On the territory of the Russian Federation, they operate completely autonomously and independently, he said. In May, Russia alleged that dozens of Ukrainian militants crossed into one of its border towns in the Belgorod region, striking targets and forcing an evacuation before more than 70 of the attackers were killed or pushed back by what authorities termed a counterterrorism operation. Ukrainian officials have denied any link with the group. Meanwhile, one Ukrainian drone struck and set ablaze an oil refinery in Nizhny Novgorod region, according to regional governor Gleb Nikitin. That region is located about 480 miles from the Ukrainian border. In another deep strike, a drone was shot down in the Moscow region, Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin said. Though it was brought down well south of the city center, the drone was close to Svyatoslavsky Airport, one of Moscow's four international airports. Another drone hit an oil depot in Oryol, 95 miles from Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said last year that his country had developed a weapon that hit a target 400 miles away, in apparent reference to the drones. The Russian Defense Ministry said Ukrainian drones were also intercepted Tuesday over the Belgorod, Bryansk, Kursk, Leningrad, and Tula regions of Russia. Kyiv has staged increasingly bold attacks beyond the 930-mile front line running through eastern and southern Ukraine. It has also increasingly deployed sea drones in the Black Sea, where it claims to have sunk Russian warships. Kyiv's forces are hoping for more military supplies from Ukraine's Western partners, but in the meantime are struggling against a bigger and better provisioned Russian army that is pressing hard at certain front-line points inside Ukraine. Zelensky said that recent Russian advances have been halted and that the battlefield situation is now significantly better than in the past 3 months. We had some difficulties due to the lack of artillery shells, long-range weapons, sky-blocking, and the high density of Russian drones, Zelensky said in an interview with France's BFM TV and Le Monde, published late Monday on the Ukrainian presidential website. Also on Tuesday, an IL-76 heavy-lift transport plane of the Russian Air Force with 15 people on board crashed while taking off from an airbase in the Ivanov region in western Russia, the defense ministry said. Its statement didn't specify whether there were any survivors. The ministry said that an engine fire during takeoff was likely the cause of the crash.
Officials say a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen was killed. The Israeli military on Tuesday announced Itai Chan, a 19-year-old Israeli soldier and American citizen previously believed to be held hostage in Gaza, is dead. Chan was killed on October 7th, and his body was taken to Gaza, where it is currently, the Israeli military said. Chan, a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, served in the Israeli Army's 75th Battalion. He was survived by his parents and two brothers. In an opinion article published in USA Today, Ruby Chen described his son as a fun-loving kid who loves playing basketball with his brothers. He had met with U.S. officials, including President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, and called on them and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to secure the release of hostages, including his son. Biden, in a statement Tuesday, said he was devastated to learn of Itai Chen's death and said he will continue working to bring the remaining hostages home. Today, as we join Itai's parents, brothers, and family in grieving this tragic loss, we keep this reminder close to our hearts, Biden said. And I reaffirm my pledge to all the families of those still held hostage. We are with you. We will never stop working to bring your loved ones home. On Monday, Ruby Chen said in a statement, "Our hearts are broken. We loved him so much, and we would have done anything to bring him home alive," Harris reported. He urged Netanyahu and the Biden administration to do everything in their power to secure the return of their son's body and the remaining hostages. "We have come to know all of the families who are waiting for their loved ones, and we will not stop working until every single hostage comes home," the statement said. Hamas is still believed to be holding around 100 hostages and the remains of 30 others after freeing most of the rest last year in exchange for the release of Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. The war began when Hamas-led militants stormed into Israel in a surprise attack on October 7th, killing some 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and taking around 250 hostages. Negotiations for a ceasefire and hostage deal remain stalled. Majid al-Ansari, spokesman for Qatar's foreign ministry, said Tuesday an agreement is not close. CIA Director William Burns said in a House hearing, there's still the possibility of a deal, but many obstacles remain. A strike on a home in Gaza's central city of Deir al-Balah early Tuesday killed 11 people from the same family, including 4 women and 5 children, according to hospital records and an Associated Press reporter who saw the bodies arrive. 9 people were killed and dozens injured when Israeli forces opened fire on crowds trying to get access to aid trucks in Gaza City's Kuwait Square, Reuters reported, citing Palestinian health officials. Meanwhile, the war threatens to spill over across the Middle East as Iran-backed groups allied with Hamas trade fire with U.S. and Israeli forces. A pair of Israeli airstrikes hit targets in northern Lebanon on Tuesday, killing at least 2 people and injuring at least 20 others, said the Associated Press, citing a Lebanese security official. The first humanitarian ship using a new maritime corridor departed Cyprus on Tuesday and headed for Gaza, where more than 2 million people face an increasing threat of starvation, and reports of malnutrition-related deaths are rising, health officials and aid organizations say. An annual threat assessment by the U.S. Intelligence Committee said Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right coalition may be in jeopardy after the war in Gaza. Distrust of Netanyahu's ability to rule has deepened and broadened across the public from its already high levels before the war, and we expect large protests demanding his resignation and new elections, the report said. A different, more moderate government is a possibility. The assessment, put together by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, also said Israel will probably face lingering armed resistance from Hamas for years to come, and the military will struggle to neutralize the group's underground infrastructure. Netanyahu, however, maintains that victory would come just weeks after an invasion of Rafah, the southernmost city in Gaza. His government's stated goal in the war is a complete destruction of Hamas.
Thank you, Barb. Here's just a couple of shorts from the States before we take our break. From Des Moines, in 2023, Iowa's daily traffic fatality count was more than 20% higher than the 5-year average. Missouri sees dozens of deceased and neglected dogs and cats from the Topeka home of Charles Solomon and Desiree Terrien. The couple's 2-year-old daughter wasn't taken into custody, however. And finally, from Louisville, Kentucky. A new Republican-led joint resolution would declare Kentucky a sanctuary state from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's regulation on fossil fuel-fired power plants, directing the state's Energy and Environment Cabinet to defy federal air pollution rules. Well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb DeHack and Dennis May, and it has been our pleasure to read for you. Now we're going to take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers for the Des Moines Register are Patty Daniels, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. We'll continue with articles next from the opinion section of USA Today from the Des Moines Register. So here is Patty with our next article.
Hypocritical? New York uses troops and gets cheers. Written for us by Ingrid Schock. Last week, New York Governor Kathy Hochul deployed hundreds of National Guard members to New York City's subway stations to search bags for weapons in an effort to combat rising crime. New Yorkers have felt increasingly anxious about riding the subway, and the governor thought the presence of the soldiers would ease their worries. The governor has said it's a temporary measure. We have seen a number of crimes, and again, not statistically significant, but psychologically significant, Hochul told MSNBC. If you feel better walking past someone in a uniform to make sure that someone doesn't bring a knife or a gun on the subway, then that's exactly why I did it. Good for her, right? Yet, Hochul's tough on crime measure has riled conservatives, not so much because of what she's doing, but because of the hypocrisy it has revealed on the left. It all has to do with the political persuasion of who is making the call to send in the troops. Let me explain. Rewind the clock to 2020. In June that year, just days after the murder of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton penned an op-ed that ran in the New York Times with this headline, "Send in the troops." Cotton essentially argued that some military reinforcement might be necessary to protect cities and businesses from the rioting and looting that was happening purportedly in response to Floyd's death. It is not a new phenomenon for bad actors to take advantage of a tragedy. Donald Trump, who was president at the time, has said that he was open to similar action, so Cotton's opinion was far from fringe. One thing above all else will restore order to our streets, an overwhelming show of force to disperse, detain, and ultimately deter lawbreakers, Cotton wrote. That doesn't sound all that different from what Hochul just did. Cotton's mere suggestion of involving troops was enough for all hell to break loose. The backlash by progressives inside and out of the Times newsroom led to the vilification of not only the senator, but also the newspaper's top opinion editor, James Bennett. He lost his job as a result. Here's the difference, though. Hochul is a Democrat. Cotton is a Republican. As an example of the inconsistent reaction to these instances, take a look at what Times editorial board member Mara Gay had to say about the governor's decision. New York City cannot function without a thriving subway, and ensuring that the system not only is safe but feels safe is paramount, Gay wrote. So Governor Kathy Hochul's decision to deploy 750 National Guard members and 250 New York State police officers to the subways after a spate of attacks is the right one. Compare that with her reaction, in 2020 to Cotton's idea of sending in troops to protect cities from violence. Gay wrote this on X, formerly Twitter, after the Times published Cotton's opinion column. Running this puts black people in danger, and other Americans standing up for our humanity and democracy, too. That's why so many conservatives are left shaking their heads, wondering when Cotton will get his apology. Bennett deserves one, too. They won't get it, of course. Imagine if it weren't Hochul who made this call, but another governor, say Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. I guarantee the reaction on the left would be 100% different. DeSantis would be framed as a tyrant or someone on a power trip who couldn't be trusted. Hochul, on the other hand, simply wants to put people's minds at ease. This is Hypocrisy 101, and it deserves to be called out. And Ingrid Schock is a columnist at USA Today.
The second piece on the opinion page today is by Rex Hupke. We would be lucky if Katie Britt were Trump's running mate. I'm going to have to insist Donald Trump pick Alabama Senator Katie Britt, giver of the most bizarrely hilarious State of the Union response in recorded history, as his running mate. She's reportedly on his list, and since I don't ask for much in this world, it seems a perfectly reasonable request that Trump choose a vice presidential candidate who has the potential to be Sarah Palin 2.0. Come on, Trump, do it. Everyone's saying you won't do it. I dare you. If you've been absent from this earth lately, Britt was the Republican Party's choice to respond to President Joe Biden's State of the Union speech last week. Despite being a lawyer, the first female head of the Alabama Business Council, and the youngest Republican woman ever elected to the U.S. Senate, the GOP decided to have Britt, age 42, speak from her kitchen. A not particularly subtle choice for a party itching to go back in time. She then delivered a speech that can best be described as overwrought theater kid whose life didn't work out the way she hoped auditioning for the part of frightened mom. Vacillating between forced smiles and near teary terror, Britt did the thing Trump is best at, trying to scare insecure white people with nonsense. Britt spoke in weirdly breathy tones about the horrors she claims Biden has brought upon our apparently once perfect nation, and even unspooled a tale of a woman who was a victim of sex trafficking, neglecting to add some important details, like the fact that the woman was kept in captivity when George W. Bush was the U.S. president, and the fact that the woman was never trafficked to the United States. The victim, later identified as Carla Jacinto, criticized the senator in a Sunday interview. CNN national correspondent Rafael Romo said she told him in Spanish, "Someone using my story and distorting it for political purposes is not fair at all." So Britt has the comfortable with being dishonest part down pat, and that has to be a prerequisite for any Trump running mate, given the next time the former president tells the truth will be the first. Once the American public recovered from its collective cringe over the Alabama senator's primetime performance, comedians and late-night hosts swiftly took to lampooning her speech, which was all but impossible. Even the great Scarlett Johansson, playing Britt on last week's Saturday Night Live, couldn't fully capture the unnuanced absurdity of the senator's response. Britt, in one short speech, transcended satire and entered a realm of ridiculousness few ever reach. She put herself up there in Palin territory. You remember Sarah Palin, right? The Alaska governor, whom Senator John McCain picked as his presidential running mate in 2008, the one who said Obamacare would lead to death panels, and talked about then-President Barack Obama's hopey-changey stuff, and fabulously bonkered up the story of Paul Revere, saying he warned the British that they weren't going to be taking away our arms by riding those bells and making sure as he was riding his horse through town to send those warning shots and bells that we were going to be secure and we were going to be free. Britt is a failed vice presidential bid and a reality show on two away from being Palin. And as a person who has to write about Trump's campaign this year, I think she's the perfect pick. As a young mother who supported overturning Roe v. Wade and is comfortable lying and fear-mongering from a kitchen, Britt represents what some Republican men incorrectly think suburban women look like. Let's put it this way. Republicans actually believe Americans want more Trump. So why wouldn't they believe Americans also want more Palin, or in this case, Sarah Palin Light? It's a match made in heaven. Britt appears fully comfortable not upstaging Trump by being a more serious or presidential figure. She would dutifully parrot his nonsense and effortlessly dissemble on his behalf, all while keeping late-night show writing teams and liberal satirists like myself challenged, trying to find a way to accurately lampoon that which is already lampooning itself. Do it, Donald Trump. Make Senator Katie Britt your running mate. Trump Palin 2.0 is just the laugh America needs right now. Again, that by USA columnist Rex Hupke.
We'll now go to sports section, and I am going to read the sports on television for today, Wednesday, March 13th. Now, all of these times are Eastern Standard. College basketball, men's, 11:30 a.m., USA Atlantic 10 tournament, George Mason versus St. Joseph's. Second round, Brooklyn, New York. 12 p.m., ESPN Atlantic Coast Tournament, Florida State versus Virginia Tech. Second round, Washington, D.C. 12:30 p.m., ESPN 2, Big 12 Tournament, BYU versus Oklahoma State. UCF winner, second round, Kansas City, Missouri. 2 p.m., USA Atlantic 10 Tournament, VCU versus Fordham Davidson winner, second round, Brooklyn, New York. MWN Mountain West Tournament, Wyoming versus Fresno State, first round, Las Vegas. 2:30 ESPN Atlantic Coast Tournament, Wake Forest versus Georgia Tech, Notre Dame winner, second round, Washington, D.C. PAC 12 tournament, Washington versus Southern Cal, first round, Las Vegas. 4 p.m. FS1 Big East tournament, Xavier versus Butler, first round, New York. 4:30 p.m. MWN Mountain West tournament, Colorado versus San Jose State, first round, Las Vegas. 5 p.m. ESPN2 Sutherland Tournament, Lamar McNeese State winner versus Texas. A&M Corpus Christi Nicole State winner championship, Lake Charles, Louisiana. USA Atlantic 10 Tournament, St. Bonaventure versus LaSalle, George Washington winner, second round, Brooklyn, New York. 5:30 p.m., PAC 12N Pac-12 Tournament, UCLA versus Oregon State, first round, Las Vegas. 6:30 p.m., FS1 Big East Tournament, Georgetown versus Providence, first round, New York. Peacock Big Ten Tournament, Rutgers versus Maryland, first round, Minneapolis. 7 p.m., CBSSN Patriot League Tournament, Colgate-Bucknell winner versus Lehigh-Boston U winner. Championship ESPN2, Atlantic Coast Tournament, Syracuse versus Louisville, NC State winner, second round, Washington, D.C. MWN Mountain West Tournament, New Mexico versus Air Force, first round, Las Vegas. SECN Southeastern Tournament, Vanderbilt versus Arkansas, first round, Nashville, Tennessee. 7:30 p.m., CBSSN Patriot League Tournament, Lehigh at Colgate Championship. USA Atlantic 10 tournament, Duquesne versus Rhode Island, St. Louis, winner, second round, Brooklyn, New York. FS1, Big East tournament, DePaul versus Villanova, first round, New York. PAC-12N, Pac-12 tournament, California versus Stanford, first round, Las Vegas. Peacock, Big Ten tournament, Michigan versus Penn State, first round, Minneapolis. 9:30 p.m., ESPN2, Big 12 tournament, Kansas versus West Virginia, Cincinnati, winner. Second round, Kansas City, Missouri. ESPNU, Atlantic Coast Tournament, Clemson versus Miami, Boston College winner. Second round, Washington. D.C., SECN, Southeastern Tournament, Missouri versus Georgia, first round, Nashville, Tennessee. 11:30 p.m., ESPN2, Big Sky Tournament, Sacramento State versus, Montana State, Sacramento State, Montana State, winner versus Idaho State and the Montana winner, championship, Boise, Idaho. FS1, Pac-12 tournament, Utah versus Arizona State, first round, Las Vegas. College basketball women's, 5 p.m., ESPNU, Big Sky Tournament, TBD, championship would be in Boise, Idaho. 7 p.m., ESPNU, American Athletic Tournament, TBD, that's to be determined, championship, Fort Worth, Texas. 10:30 p.m., CBSSN, Mountain West Tournament, TBD, championship, Las Vegas. College softball, 7 p.m., ACCN, Alabama at Florida State. Major League Baseball, 1 p.m., MLBN, Spring Training, Boston versus New York Yankees, Tampa, Florida. 4 p.m., MLBN, Spring Training, Seattle versus L.A. Dodgers in Phoenix. NBA Basketball, 7:40 p.m., ESPN Denver at Miami. 10:05 p.m., ESPN L.A. Lakers at Sacramento. NHL Hockey, 7:30 p.m., TNT and Max, Los Angeles at St. Louis. 10 p.m., TNT, True TV, and Max, Washington at Edmonton. And for soccer, men's soccer, 4 p.m., FS2, the French Cup, Nice at Paris, Saint-Germain, quarterfinal. 5:55 p.m., FS2, CONCACAF Champions Cup, SV Robin Hood versus CS Herediano, round 16, leg 2, Paramaribo, Suriname. 7:55 p.m., FS2 CONCACAF Champions Cup, Nashville, South Carolina at Inter Miami, CF, round of 16, leg 2. 10:20 p.m., FS2 CONCACAF Champions Cup, Guadalajara at Club America, round of 16, leg 2. And tennis. BNP Paribas Open, ATP/WTA, round of 15, ATP doubles semifinals, WTA doubles quarterfinals. 10 p.m., tennis, BNP Paribas Open, ATP/WTA, round of 16, ATP doubles semifinals, WTA doubles quarterfinals.
We'll take bits and pieces of Randy Peterson's article on college men's basketball. We just have a few minutes. He writes, "We overreact. It's one of our specialties. Everyone does it occasionally, especially when a very good sports team goes through an untimely mini-stretch of unsightly games. Concern about an Iowa State men's basketball team that hasn't exactly played its best during the last few games is real. The shooting hasn't been good. Lockdown defense has sporadically fallen off. Key players have been AWOL during important moments. For the Cyclones, it's a concerning trend. Good news is there's adequate time to work on things before Thursday's 6 p.m. quarterfinal game against Kansas State or Texas at the Big 12 Conference Tournament in Kansas City. My guess is that Coach T.J. Otzelberger addressed those issues and maybe more in the locker room immediately after Saturday's troubling loss at Kansas State. I'm guessing he made his points very clear. This is no time to spoil what's been one of the best seasons in Iowa State history. And yes, that's what it's been, despite recent games that haven't lived up to the resume. I asked the Des Moines Register's Iowa State text group for their thoughts as the Cyclones head into a tournament during which they can regain some of the mojo they've lost." Then Peterson goes on to list some of the items that came from his text group. The first comment was that clunker should help refocus all of them in practice. And Peterson says, "You think, right? I'm pretty sure TJ got their attention very soon after the game. He even singled out Milan Momcilovic specifically during the post game, which he doesn't often do." One text group member said he's worried about Taman Lipsey, who's not been the same since his injury. Peterson says, "Except for the most recent BYU game, Lipsey hasn't played up to the high bar that he set. Whether that has anything to do with the January shoulder sprain, I really doubt it." Text group, "Will anyone be added to the postseason rotation?" Peterson says Demarion Watson didn't play in the second half against Kansas State. He was in concussion protocol. Even with that, the rotation won't include anyone new. And text group, "I have confidence the team will play better. My only worry is the NCAA tournament if the referees won't let us play our tough, tenacious defense." And Peterson says, "That's always a concern. The NCAA tournament is about matchups with opponents and refs. First things first, Kansas City barbecue awaits." So that from Randy Peterson, who's soon to retire from the Des Moines Register. It's time to turn to Dear Abby. There are two letters and two responses today. I'll read the first letter and response. Patty, if you'll take the second letter and response. Dear Abby, years ago, I sat over lunch reading your mom's definition of maturity. It was shortly after my dad died, and reading it made me realize how lucky I had been. Those were all lessons I learned at home from my parents. Perhaps this item is in your booklet, but could you print it in your column again for other readers to see? It's an important reminder of what to strive for. Signed, Mary H. in Iowa. Dear Mary, I'm doing that with pleasure. I agree that Mama's definition of maturity is a timely reminder and perhaps something that people of all ages can learn from today. So here it is, definition of maturity. Maturity is the ability to stick with a job until it's finished, the ability to do a job without being supervised, the ability to carry money without spending it, and the ability to bear an injustice without wanting to get even. You were correct when you guessed that her definition of maturity is part of the Keepers booklet. Keepers is a collection of articles that readers suggested we put together in booklet form, many of which readers had hung on to until they were worn and yellowed with age. What resulted was a book that booklet that contains clever observations and items on diverse subjects, including parenting, children, aging, animals, forgiveness, and more. It can be ordered by sending your name and address plus a check or money order of U.S. funds for $8 to Dear Abby Keeper's Booklet, Post Office Box 447, Mount Morris, Illinois, 61054. Both witty and philosophical, the Keeper's Booklet is an inexpensive welcome gift for newly married couples, pet lovers, or anyone recovering from an illness, and filled with down-to-earth, witty, and philosophical nuggets of wisdom.
Thank you. Dear Abby, in the past, my husband of 22 years traveled often for work. He had an emotional affair with a coworker he met on one of these trips. He never saw her again. After that, he became distant and sometimes rude toward me. We went to marriage therapy, which helped. I was recovering when one day a friend of mine told me my husband had called her and said, "I think about you." She called me immediately afterward. I am very hurt. Now it's hard for me to believe him and trust him. He had a problem in the past with pornography, but he is not doing it anymore, and he has changed jobs. Is there hope for our marriage? Can I trust him again? Signed, Heartbroken in Virginia. Dear Heartbroken, there may be hope if the two of you are able to get to the root of why your husband may be looking for something outside of your marriage. This should be done with the help of a licensed marriage and family counselor. However, you should not trust him again unless you are certain he is truly penitent. Or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069.
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Wednesday, March 13th. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Patty Daniels. Earlier, you heard Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.